Hello and welcome to another episode of Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. I'm Lita.
I'm Ron.
And I'm Jean Marie.
Collectively, we're the hosts of Podcast DX. On today's show, we are talking with Brian Talley about osteomyelitis. Brian is a former sergeant for the U.S. Marines. Who is currently introducing his own bills through Congress to help close a loophole at the VA or the Veterans Administration hospital systems for medical malpractice. He himself ended up in critical condition with osteomyelitis after malpractice at his local VA.
Hi, Brian. Thanks so much for joining our show this morning.
Hey, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, Brian, could you start us off by telling us more about osteomyelitis, what it is, what causes it, and how you ended up with it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, osteomyelitis is something I've never even heard of until, you know, obviously we found out over 4 months later that I had it in my spine. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those infections that, you know, that your body will pick up. Typically through some sort of a scratch or a cut, or something like that on me, which I never had, which made it, you know, very, difficult for us to understand why or how I even had something like that in my body.
Sure.
I know for a fact that one of the infectious disease doctors came in and actually was saying that I could have transmitted something, or I could have gotten it in me, you know, 10 years ago. He even said it could have been even further than that.
Wow.
And what it did is it kind of went in and attached to my spine, and it stayed there until it woke up. So it's pretty wild.
Yeah, that's rough. And infections can also begin in the bone itself if there's an injury that exposes the bone to germs. And smokers and people with chronic health conditions such as diabetes, kidney failure, and the like are more at risk of developing osteomyelitis. And people who have diabetes may also develop osteomyelitis in their feet, especially if they have open foot ulcers. And in most cases with osteomyelitis, it's caused by Staphylococcus bacteria, and there are several different varieties of Staphylococcus bacteria. And these are types of germs that are typically actually found on your skin naturally, in your nasal cavity, in your nasal passages, and on most healthy individuals. And germs can enter the bone in a variety of ways, including the bloodstream from other parts of the body, for example, in the lungs, you know, if you have pneumonia or if you have a bladder infection or urinary tract infection, and they can travel through your bloodstream to a weakened spot in a bone, or like a defect. And then severe puncture wounds can also carry germs deep inside your body. And I know you were stationed overseas quite a bit, and I know we've heard tell about not only staph infections, but also yeast infections and fungal infections that are occurring in greater numbers from people that were overseas, and unusual infections as well that they're seeing years after the fact. And I'm sorry that they weren't able to isolate your specific infection, but like what symptoms did you have, and what symptoms did you first notice that had you go to a healthcare provider?
Yeah, you know, so that's all really good information. And that was the crazy thing that my family and I and the doctors all were scratching their heads on. I don't have any of those factors. I didn't have diabetes. I didn't have any of these underlying symptoms or these underlying causes that would bring this sort of in infection on. Mm-hmm. What it was is pretty much the onset was almost immediate. Couldn't get out of bed. I was sweating profusely. And what I mean sweating profusely, it's like you put a water hose in my bed.
Wow.
My blankets were drenched. My sheet was drenched. And I just ended up on my bathroom floor just trying to get the cold relief of the tile on my back to give me anything, you know, some sort of relief as I was battling some of the most excruciating pain you could ever imagine in your entire life. I didn't know what was going on. I couldn't use the bathroom, you know, and when I did sometimes, you know, it would just drip into a bucket because I couldn't stand up or sit down on the toilet. So it was very, it was very egregious. You know, I kind of felt like a prisoner in your own home trying to figure out what in the heck just hit you. So,
and it and the onset was very rapid, right?
It just hit you out of the blue?
Yeah. Oh, geez.
Yeah, it was immediate. And what I mean by immediate, it was immediate, like right now. And the pain was unlike anything you can ever imagine unless you yourself have been eaten alive. You know, it's something that it's hard to even put into words.
Right. And you're a Marine, and Marines are known to be extraordinarily tough people. And yeah, I'm so sorry.
This came on all of a sudden. I'm sure you were like, what in the world is happening? How long did it take you to get some type of diagnosis to at least say, hey, at least I know what it is?
That took just over 4 months.
4 months.
So you were in that pain for 4 months before they were able to diagnose you?
Yeah, well, see, in the very beginning when I was having the crazy night sweat and the pain and all the suffering I was going through, my wife took to the VA emergency room where they diagnosed me. They took one x-ray. They diagnosed me with a low back sprain, which was, again, very confusing to us. I didn't suffer any trauma. And at that point, they just injected me with shots of Dilaudid and Kenalog and Metoclopramide and sent me on my way with a bag of pills and said I would be okay in the next 2 weeks. 2 days later, we ended up right back at their front doorstep with the VA ER. This time I was in a wheelchair. I couldn't walk. My wife was crying. She was advocating for me in the VA ER. They stated to her once again, it was a low back sprain, and I need to follow up with my primary care physician. Oh, at that time, she stated and begged and pleaded with them to get a blood test.
Mm-hmm.
And in an MRI, you know, some of the simplest diagnostic tools that you can use for one that was in pain, especially for doctors, or not the doctors, I never saw them, but the clinicians there, and the ER, the triage nurses were giving me high doses of narcotic and not even checking their work on a simple blood test to find out why they were giving me the narcotic.
Right.
And, you know, of course, I wasn't in the state of mind to even question what they were doing because I was in severe pain. So, you know, I'm completely incapacitated, taking all the shots and injections, just trying to give me some relief and to put me into a state of not really caring on what's going on. While my wife was frantically advocating for something to be done to find out what the root of the problem was and not just putting Band-Aids over.
Right. Yeah, and you would think that a blood test, a blood panel would be...
A routine?
Yeah, right. Yeah, especially with the excessive sweating.
Right. Did you have a fever or did they take your temperature?
I don't even remember that. All I know is that we went in there with a ton of symptoms. Mm-hmm. And a ton of issues, and they pretty much just got me in and out in a few minutes. The ER was packed, but that's really no excuse. I mean, the problem now, looking back at this, is really a shame that they didn't consider me severe enough to see a doctor. You know, mm-hmm. I never even saw a doctor. You know, when I was in the ER both times.
Wow.
A tough one to swallow there, you know, especially when they could have treated this with simple antibiotics and I would have been in and out and I would have been, pretty good in about a week or so. I would have went back to work and would have went on with my life. But because of what happened in those first few visits to the ER, it's kind of set up my life over the last 4 years now, which has been a very, very, very difficult one, to say the least.
Now, you said that they wanted you to follow up with your primary care. Would that also be a VA primary care physician?
Yes, she works at the VA as well, my primary care. We finally got in with her. It took quite some time. And she was so busy that she couldn't see me. So she saw me and my wife in passing. You know, but by the time I saw her, it was probably about 3 to 4 days after my second ER visit. And like I said, she couldn't see us, so she saw us in passing in a hallway. You know, I'm on a walker. I'm already down 40 pounds. And she did not order an MRI or any blood test after my wife said completed with her. She said that she agreed with the original diagnosis that were given by the ER clinicians, and you know, and we went on, and I went home, and that's where I began to slowly die in my chair.
How did you get a diagnosis? How did you get proper care?
About a month later, my wife said, "Enough's enough. You're not getting any better. We keep calling the VA. They keep saying that, you know, that I'm fine and this and that." So we paid out of pocket for our own MRI, and we went.
Oh, and that's a big expense.
The MRI, yeah, and it stated that I had severe trauma, that I had severe back problems. And again, I never had any back problems in my life. There's no reason for this. And so my wife picked that up, and she immediately hand-delivered it to both the VAER, the orthopedic department, as well as my primary care, and said, "We are trying to tell you that we have a problem here.
Right.
And please address this problem, because my husband's dying here, and we don't know what's wrong with him. But we do have this MRI that says that he needs surgery."
Mm-hmm.
So this was in March now, okay? So okay. Now we're several months into this with you. And they took it and they scheduled surgery for December the 9th, which would have been another nine months, which would have definitely killed me.
Wow.
So again, my wife starts to beg and plead in tears, and began to advocate that we need something done, like, you know, immediate, as this is, you know, an emergency. The VA finally agreed that they would send me out on the Veterans Choice Enrollment program, which was very new back in 2016. And obviously, that move right there, you know, was one that would ultimately end up saving my life.
With that, you got to choose an outside doctor, and the VA would pay for it. Is that right?
Yeah, I didn't get to choose. The VA selected. They just select a doctor in your area, you know. So in my case, they selected an orthopedic surgeon, and I went in and I saw him. He saw my MRI. There was still no blood test taken. There was still no MRI, nothing to ever check the work of anybody except for this MRI that I had just gotten from a completely independent doctor that
sure.
had no relation to the VA. So at that point, he scheduled me for about a month out. So, to the surgeon's surprise, as I lay open on the operating table, he saw something that my spine had been mossy, and I had severe inflammation in my spine. It's not something that he had seen before. And so he was concerned, and he called in the infectious disease doctor, and at that time, they started to cut some spinal bone out and tissue, and began to scrape nerves and, like I said, the tissues, the discs, and the lower part of my back, and it kind of just ran itself up my spine.
When you say moth-eaten, Brian, are you saying that the bone itself was, like, deteriorated, like something had been chewing on it?
Yes.
Oh, my God. No wonder you were in excruciating pain. I cannot even imagine what that would have felt like.
Yeah, he said moth eaten. That's the description he gave. So at that time, they were freaking out. They thought I had bone cancer, and they didn't know what was going on. They went to my chart. There was nothing there. There was nothing that they could even, you know, equate to, because I didn't have any of these profiles, these blood tests or anything like that running up to my surgery. So they got me at my absolute worst, which he thought that I should have died 2 weeks into this infection. But my body ended up fighting this for 4 months. And he said that it's one of the craziest things he's seen, because I should have developed sepsis, which would have killed me almost probably within days of having that, because of the condition that my spine was in. You know, and there's something else too, besides the osteomyelitis, there's something called discitis, I think it's called.
Okay.
And, you know, I had that, So I had that going on in there too with the severe infection. Like I said, it was all just set up in my spine and in my belly and in my gut. So it did a tremendous damage to my bladder.
So it actually spread to your organs.
My bladder, like I had to cath myself, you know, or I'll have to using the bathroom about 25 to 30, 32 times a day because I don't have a stream or a flow. It drips out. So okay. It's very, you know, so it's, you know, and then kidney problems, my ability to, you know, reproduce and, you know, and stuff like that, all that stuff been eliminated.
Was that all nerve related, did they say?
Was it what?
Nerve. I'm thinking that might have been nerve damage.
Yeah, well, a lot of that stuff was cut. So
right.
So with nerve damage on top of the stuff, disconnect to remove the infection from that area. So
right.
Spread, you know, and so when I woke up, I had a PICC line in my arm. They ran me through 4 months of extensive IV antibiotics. You know, and, you know, when I woke up, they had told my wife what was going on, and they didn't want to worry me, you know, because they had used that word cancer and stuff like that. So they ran me through probably 100 different types of tests there before
wow.
I left. I mean, I remember barely even conscious. I remember these folks coming in, they were drawing blood, there had tubes coming out of my arms everywhere, and they were mixing powder like substances with my blood. They were checking for this and that, CT scans, EKGs, any testing that they have in hospital, they ran through it. And they ran me through it directly after my surgery, so it wasn't very comfortable. They started on my back, and then they saw all the problems, and then they flipped me over, and they went through my belly, moved my gut, across, and started going in from the front side as well. So
the post-operative recovery, that had to be horrible as well.
Yeah, the recovery was hard. I spent 3 years in a chair.
How many? 3 years. Oh.
Yeah. Because the problem was,
it destroyed your back so badly.
Yeah, so nobody knew what I was about to go through because there's not a story that I can base what other people have gone through, because I can't find anybody in the country that lived with a bone eating staph infection in their spine for 4 months, because I'm trying to find them,
mm-hmm.
and especially after this happened, so I know what to expect.
Right. I hate to say this, but maybe you'd have to be looking in countries where the medical care isn't
the best.
Right.
I mean, that maybe that's why, you know, you're not finding them, because doctors usually discover this early on and take care of it. You know, unfortunately, you got dropped through the cracks.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so I didn't know what to expect. So, you know, because of what happened, it's become a major snowball effect. You know, because of this, now I now have this. And because of that, I now have this. And because of this, I now have that. So, so now I have over 20-some diagnoses of medical conditions that were all related and all stemming back to the original bone eating staph infection I had that destroyed my spine and that of my gut. And it just, you know, was an ongoing thing. So now I have to take certain medications to take care of this and that. So it's just, between, having neuropathy and, of course, severe arthritis now, and, all the degeneration sitting in a chair for 3 years, to the radiculopathy and, IVDS, which is the disc type syndrome in your body that, is very, very painful. A lot of permanent nerve damage that stems all the way from the tips of my fingers, all the way up through my spine, all the way up through my C spine, down into my feet. And, and then on top of that all, having a neurogenic bladder now.
Right.
Because it doesn't work. So here I was at 38 years old. Now I got to cath myself,
Right.
I'm going to be 43 here tomorrow. It's been a rough 4 years.
Yeah.
So, a lot of, you know, anxiety and depression sitting in a chair for years and years as your livelihood's been completely stripped away from you and you're just trying to figure out, man, what the heck happened here?
Right. I mean, you were self-employed as a landscape architect before, right?
Yeah, I was a landscape contractor. I did a lot of custom work, and I was a hands-on owner. I loved my job, very passionate about landscaping. And, you know, because we didn't know what was going to go on. So months went, and then a year went by, and then a year and a half, and then I started to lose equipment. I lost my business, lost my family car. I still haven't worked in 4 years because I suffer from severe chronic pain. You know, and then of course, you know, my bladder, you know, irritable bowel syndrome, I've had to have colonoscopies, and, you know, it's just one thing after another between, you know, dealing with pain management, getting my injection, you know, constantly in physical therapy, trying to walk, trying to get better. It's pretty difficult to do with the amount of, you know, things that are wrong that aren't going to be fixed. The only thing you can do is try to change your diet, in which I have. I've lost 9 months, or I've lost 70 pounds over 9 months. Oh, wow. I haven't eaten, you know, in 9 months. I do a lot of intermittent fasting. Now, I'm doing everything I can to help myself, but still, there are so many challenges that I face every single day because, I mean, let's face it here, my daily life is based on my medical condition, for the rest of my life,
right.
Which is, you know, something that's, you know, I never planned on, but that's life, I guess. You know, some people get these hands dealt with them, and you just got to figure out, you know, what you can do to make the best of it. It took me over 3 years to figure this stuff out, you know, but, you know, dealing with pain is much easier to do when you're happy than it is when you're depressed.
Sure.
You know, an anxiety-riddled body.
So yeah, that's definitely a snowball.
I'm trying to get better every day. Yeah.
Brian, I hesitate to ask this question because of how you described your care, but...
or lack thereof.
Yeah, exactly. But what do you wish the VA would have done differently when you first went in? And moving forward, what can they do to improve patient care, in your opinion?
I wish they would have just done a blood test because that would have told them everything that they need to move forward in the right direction. That would have saved me a lot of my last 4 years. It would have saved me my business. It would have saved me my livelihood. To move forward, it would have also saved my spine and my health.
Right.
Because this has taken years off of my life. And that's not fair to my children. It's not fair to my wife. It's not fair to the folks that love me. It's not fair to me.
Oh, absolutely.
Second, how can they improve patient care? They need to listen to their... They need to do a better job of listening to the folks that are in there in their most desperate time in need. Unfortunately, we live in a society today where the ER is full of folks that have a runny nose.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it completely clogs up the system. So when you have folks that are in dire need, they get blown off and they get pushed away. So, you know, there really needs to be more accessibility to clinics that can take you for a runny nose, a cough, and leave the emergency room for emergency use only. And see, that's the problem within the VA right now is, see, if I had the flu, okay, like Lita, if I wanted to go see my doctor, it's a 3 to 4 month wait.
You'll be over the flu by then, right.
Or have pneumonia.
Yeah, so you have to go to the ER, okay? So when you're in the ER, there's 100 other people in there, and again, they want to see you really fast and get you in and out, and they ignore why you're actually in there, and that's ruining lives.
And the fact that we are in a society now with the opioid addiction, and a lot of people are trying to get relief from pain, and they go to the emergency room because their doctors might not be prescribing the pain relief that they need. And they might have thought that you were just somebody that had chronic pain that was looking for a relief. Right. And they thought, oh, he just wants pain relief medicine. Let's give it to him.
And I hate to say this because, you know, like I understand that like computers are far more in our, you know, they're in our lives more and more often. But I know I have been reading some research that sometimes you do need to utilize a computer as part of the diagnosis process. Because sometimes the clinician is adding their own personal spin. Like they may,
like I was just
like
saying,
you were just saying, right. They may feel everyone's coming in for opioids and they won't take everything seriously. And also, like using computers to as a flow chart to aid in the diagnosis and treatment, because they can ask you questions that they may, you know, like they can, you can run through those questions and those can take you to different areas. Like
right.
You would say, you know,
you're sweating,
right. You're having problems with bowel and bladder control and things that the clinician may not have time for.
The computer.
But it can highlight those things for the clinician and say, hey, you know what? You also need, you need to look at in this direction. And just try to free up some of their time. But I applaud your advice in saying that, you know, they do need more day clinics in the VA system.
Right.
And we totally understand. Lita and I are both veterans, and we both worked through the VA system, and we've both had extreme problems because of not being able to
be seen,
to get access to care, being... like my mother couldn't get in to see, I'm sorry, I'm going off on a tangent, but she couldn't get into the women's health clinic back in the 70s because there was no women's health clinic. And I couldn't get out of the women's health clinic even though I had a
brain
and spinal injury and I needed specialized, you know,
neuro care. And they stuck her
and
in.
I was stuck in OBGYN.
Yeah.
And we
both ended up with. Same as you, you know, dragged
out. Not same.
Well, no, but dragged out.
Yeah. And painful.
And waiting and months later.
And well, great loss.
Yeah, now it's too late. Now you got to have surgery.
Right. And again, not being able to even see a physician.
So we understand.
Yeah.
And that's why we were excited to talk to you. But I think the most exciting thing that we want to talk to you about is...
the tally bill.
Yes.
Please, again, we're all... saddened to hear about what happened, but we're aware that you have a bill in Congress or something like that. We're trying to change liability law.
Yeah, so you know, give me a little run down on it because I know your listeners probably wouldn't understand going from having this bone-ending staph infection to a bill.
Mm-hmm.
I can kind of spend just a minute or two on getting us up why we have a bill. So. Right now, currently in the VA, there's a 74-year VA legal loophole, okay, that continues to this day to destroy the lives of veterans and their families after they've fallen victim to VA medical malpractice. So this generational loophole that I have discovered and found has been going on since 1946. Back in 1946, they had very few independent contractors working within the VA and behind the VA veil with VA business cards, VA doctor's notes, VA everything except for their independent contract. 1946. So what I have asked for is simply bringing up today's operational standards with having all these huge influx of independent contractors working within the VA. And the reason why is that they are working within the VA with no recourse or no accountability. So, essentially, after a veteran falls victim to VA medical malpractice, the veteran is going to file a tort claim for damages, in which we did. In my case, the VA immediately came out, and they fessed up to failing to meet the standard of care, and they admitted fault. And then they further stated that there was a breach in liability and that there was a settlement coming my way for loss of, earnings, future, past, my health, pain and suffering, so on and so forth. So nearly 1 year into my tort claim, the VA dropped a bombshell on me, and they denied my claim based on a technicality and an employment status. So what they did is they reversed course and they cited that same law from 1946 that says the VA is not responsible for settling claims if non-VA employees are named in the claim. So what they did is they threw the independent contractor under the bus. They did an about face, and then they denied my claim based on that technicality and left me and my family holding the bag with zero recourse and zero accountability. So even though I had several clinicians involved in my care that were all VA employees, they found one independent contractor that they could tie to my case, and they denied it based on that technicality alone. And that is something that is far, I don't even know what's more egregious than leading a family, a good family, down this garden path and stating that we are going to at least make sure that you're going to be okay. You're not going to lose everything you've ever worked so hard for because of our fault. And then pull the rug right out from underneath them. And this credit card debt is going through the roof, trying to figure out what the heck is going on. How are we going to survive this? So by them deflecting all the liability away from the VA, they placed it on the back of these so independent contractors that are working unidentified within the VA system. And like I mentioned, they have VA business cards. Mm-hmm. These folks have VA doctor's coats on. VA everything, being VA patients in a VA hospital. So
why wouldn't they have the responsibility?
Right, or accountability. And it's not like you're going to ask everybody, oh, are you an independent contractor? As you're lying there in agony.
In agony, right. I mean, not that you would have known to ask anyway.
Right.
Yeah, so you know, now more than ever, there are more independent contractors working within the system. But yet we're still basing everything off a 1946 law. And I can tell you why they are doing it, because I have dedicated my life to fixing this, because it has hurt me so bad. I'm working for the good of the country to protect all veterans. Mm-hmm. I've got over 10,000 hours, over 3,000 emails, over 1,500 phone calls. And I have started a grassroots effort to change federal law. And the reason why is the VA is doing this to keep from paying out rightful damages, after they have failed to meet the standard of care. And they're doing this to keep their medical malpractice numbers down in the VA. So by them landing an independent contractor for the malpractice, they don't need to report this on their yearly numbers. And at the end of the day, it didn't happen on their watch or even in their place of business, again, because it's an independent contractor. But in turn, what they have done is they've protected the contractor from having to be reported to the National Practitioner Data Bank or have any bad paper associated with their name, which will essentially wipe their slate clean because they waited so long. And then this is where I go right now. To add insult to injury on what happened to me, the day I was notified that my claim was denied due to the employment status of the independent contractor, I was instructed by the VA to file in state court against that contractor to get exactly what the VA had promised me, which was a settlement. Because of the delayed response it took from the VA, properly notify me, which was almost a year that they drug this out. After stating for almost a year that they were going to make this right, they failed to meet the standard of care, we screwed up, we are going to make this right. They came out and said, I needed to file in state court. Well, guess what? I got that letter, and my state statute of limitations had expired by days. So this left me with zero chance of accountability, zero legal recourse, zero justice. And this tactic that they are using is stripping the right to due process away from injured veterans who have already suffered mightily due to VA medical malpractice and gross negligence, causing permanent injury or even death in a lot of matters here. So I knew what had happened to me was absolutely egregious. I spent 3 years in my chair crying every single day, not knowing what's going to happen tomorrow, fearing that I'm going to lose everything, fearing that my children are and may not even have their father, just so much depression and anxiety. I said, I have got to do something. I have got to figure this out and change this law that has ruined my life and that of my family. So I dedicated my life to fixing this, and I picked up a law book, and I recruited an online legislative team, and I drafted my own bill.
Because I heard that you don't have a representative now, right?
Yeah, I live in the only district in the United States of America. Yeah, here's another wall that's been put up from me. I live in the only district in the United States of America that does not have an acting member of Congress because he was indicted and he has since been removed from Congress. So, again, I had to do this on my own, and I had to essentially become my own congressman.
Wow.
I'm a landscaper by trade. So I've had to teach myself how to effectively lobby Congress. I've had to teach myself how to draft and read legislation. And I said, if Congress is not going to do this, well, then I'm going to do it myself. And that's when I went out and I recruited a bunch of really good people, veterans from across the country, high school government teachers, and we drafted the bill. And the tally bill was born. So what did I do next? With the little money I had, I boarded a flight for Capitol Hill with a pocket full of pain pills and anxiety. And I walked the halls of Congress, going door to door, urging lawmakers to change this outdated law. And I explained to them that all veterans deserve a clear path of legal recourse and the right to due process. All veterans deserve a fair and equitable system that is set up for them to succeed, not one that will fail them in every single way, full of loopholes. And I let them know, hey, look, these necessary safeguards and accountability and transparency measures will ensure the rights and protections of all veterans. That's why we need to get these bills passed. And I'm proud of myself because not too many people can say that they had a problem. I didn't sit back and just complain about it and say, pity me, the VA is horrible. I actually think the VA does a lot of good. They do a lot of good. But there's also a lot of places where they really need some improvement. So as a veteran that was injured from this story, I said, I'm going to help bring a solution to the table. And that's what I did. And I've had three bills introduced in 16 months, all in my name. And the original bill that was introduced, in 2018, we've had two bills introduced in 2019. And in 2020, we are praying that we have law. But, this is something that we would love to get your listeners involved in because it's going to protect 20 million veterans in this country. This law, the tally bill, is going to protect folks that aren't even born yet. And so I'm very passionate about this because of the stunt that the Office of General Counsel has pulled here with me and my family and the countless of others that they pulled. So, again, the tally bill is H.R. 4526 and H.R. 3813, and I'll say it one more time to your listeners.
Sure.
I ask you to please pick up the phone and call your elected members of Congress today. H.R. 4526 and H.R. 3813, these measures will protect all veterans, it will save lives, and it will bring transparency back to the VA, where they need it the most. So...
So if everyone contacts their congressman and those congressmen get behind these bills and the bills get passed, is that the new law then, or does it have to go through the Senate as well?
So how the legislative process will work. So I'm working in the House right now. I'm also working in the Senate. I'm trying to get a Senate companion bill, but ultimately is what we need to do is get this out of the House. And we've got two active bills in the House right now, which we have a total of, I believe, about 16 or 17 co-sponsors already. That's really good. I think they know that there's an issue here, and I think that they're going to do the right thing and they should get this passed. So once it gets to the Senate, I've been told that it should go right through the Senate because if it gets out of the House, you know, because these are completely bipartisan, you know, and that's the thing. You know, these folks, Republicans, independents, Democrats, whatever side you're on, look, we need to put partisan politics aside.
You've all got veterans within your ranks.
Yes.
Yeah. This is bipartisan. Don't politicize on the backs of veterans. It's not fair because a lot of the stuff that they pull there is very fraudulent, okay? And it's not right. It doesn't need to be this way. By putting these accountability measures in place, it will ensure that no veteran will ever fall through the cracks ever, ever, ever again and have them completely ran until their state statutes completely expire, leaving them with just feeling hopeless and helpless. And it's egregious. And I mean, that's the only word I can say is because it's terrific how, you know, so many veterans have been treated. And we can do so much better as a nation. Veterans deserve, to be treated as first-class citizens. So that's my passion behind this. And, you know, we've got a website as well. It's www.talleyteam.net. That's T-A-L-L-Y team.net. You know, we also have a Facebook page as well, where we have a lot of supporters that come from across the country, and they kind of follow the legislation. They kind of follow what's going on with Case and Story. That's Rally Around Tally on Facebook. So, you know, I'm just asking folks to get involved today, you know,
sure,
and do your part in making a positive difference in the lives of all veterans.
When do you think these bills might make it through and get a vote?
I mean, there's no timeline here. I mean, that's why I'm pushing so hard, because we don't have a long time left. Look, this is an election year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, you know, it's February right now. So we've got like 6 months here to get this job done, because as soon as we get a little bit further, like into the September, October timeframe, they're not going to be doing a lot of legislating.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's running for re-election, 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 re-election. So, you know, We need to get this done, because if we don't get it done in 2020, we're going to have to start the process all over again to where we're going to have a fourth bill introduced and then complete this vicious cycle. And I'm exhausted.
I'm sure you are.
Understandably.
This job is not fun. It requires a great deal of passion. It requires a great deal of energy. And I don't have a lot of that these days, because I live in chronic pain. I have problems in my neck and in my back and everywhere else. And I want to begin to heal. And I can't do that until I get this closure here, because I can't effectively move on with my life until I know that this will never happen again. So this is going to be closure for me. And I will fight until every veteran in this country has this transparency measure and has this law from 1946 changed. And they got my promise on that. So that's the plan. And like I said, I'm tired. I would like to get this done soon.
Right.
Sure.
So I can move on.
Right.
So.
Hey, Brian, do you have any of the big veterans, what are they called?
Organizations
like VFW, yeah. Or do you have any of them behind you on this?
Oh yes, we have several VSOs who have come out and support Fleet Naval Reserve is their name. They're a big supporter. AMVETS is a huge supporter. Veteran Warriors is a big supporter. Another one is Sea Service Family Foundation as a supporter. We have the National Veterans Foundation as a supporter. I mean, we've got support coming in from from all angles. I have not been able to get through to the folks at the DAV. I don't know if they're just too busy or what, but we would like to get this put on their radar as well. Having the support from across the country that we have right now, I think is enough to get this thing across the finish line. What makes me know that we have a pace here is that we've had three bills introduced in 16 months. And, they have got to know that we've got to change this, because it's something that is such an easy fix. It's simply giving the injured veteran the employment status of the said clinician involved in a sport claim. It sounds so easy, right?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That's why it's not.
But it takes an act of Congress. It's taken me over 10,000 hours to get to where I'm at right now. We're asking for simple transparency measures, because by doing so, it's going to give the veteran the correct path to be on.
Right.
We're not asking for all these to be approved. We're asking for just a clear path of legal recourse. You know what I mean? And I am the first one that will come out and say, I don't hold grudges. I am not, I was upset at what happened. I was more sad than angry, because I understand that everybody makes mistakes. And doctors make mistakes. Nobody is perfect. But when people do commit errors, and when people do screw up, there needs to be accountability there. Just like if I did at my landscaping job, if I ended up hitting a gas line, or if I ended up, building something that fell apart, I would need to be there with my insurance,
right,
fixing these things. And the same should go for folks that are getting their medical care, through the VA. I had to carry insurance, as a contractor.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody died on a job site or car accidents or, equipment, failures and you're rolling equipment and you're getting hurt. That's put there to protect people. It's there to protect the individuals that are operating. It's there to protect your clients. It's there to protect just people that are interacting in your job. These measures, that's why we all carry insurance, right? But again, we're told that we need to live by a certain rule when other folks are allowed to have a free pass, and it doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
We are a rule, we are a nation of law, and that's what we, that's what we need to get through to the VA is that, hey, you need to act within, the Constitution, and you need to act, within just an ethics code.
You're exactly right, Brian. And I mean, we're all looking at each other in disbelief over what's going on. And from all of us, we wish you all the best with your personal health, as well as getting this bill passed, because it is going to be a game changer for people to come. And more so than anything, we do thank you for your service to our country.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you guys too. I've met a lot of really neat people have come into my life over these last 4 years. And, I'm sure a lot of these relationships that I'm building now with folks from across the country are probably going to be, sure to last a lifetime.
Absolutely.
I have a sincere, debt of gratitude to pay to a lot of folks that have supported me and helped me and have encouraged me and have inspired me to get to this point in my life. So I would like to thank you guys as well.
Well, thank you. And if our listeners have any questions or comments related to today's show, they can contact us at podcastdx@yahoo.com, through our website, podcastdx.com, on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, or Instagram. And we will be putting links for all of the contact information for Rally Around Tally and the Brian Tally bills on our website.
And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a review wherever you get your podcast. As always, please keep in mind that this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regime. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking because of something you've heard on this podcast.
Till next week.